This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we tell stories about everything here on this show, from the arts to sports, and from business to history, and everything in between, including your stories. Send them to OurAmericanStories.com. That's OurAmericanStories.com. They're some of our favorites. And we love to tell stories about faith whenever we can, and redemption. And this is one of our best redemption stories, brought to us by our very own Joey Cortez.
Ron Brown grew up on the west side of Chicago.
I grew up in a family where my uncles were drug dealers and pimps, and I saw that growing up as a kid, and it never appealed to me. I can remember as a kid seeing my uncles get shot and different things like that, and you know, one guy tried to murder my uncle, and just seeing it, and just being a kid, like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, growing up, being like, this ain't the way this is supposed to be. I watch certain stories and kids say growing up in the inner city, how they saw drug dealers and that's the only people they saw. And for them, they saw that as a means to an end to get out the ghetto as a kid, I don't know what God blessed me with, but he blessed me with the ability to see that I was wrong and that wasn't the way for me to go about my life.
He was also blessed with a strong mother who divorced his biological father when Ron was a kid.
I can remember he was part of an accident fraud scheme. And I remember being a kid telling him, I was like, hey, man, you're going to get in trouble. He'd say, son, you know what? I'm making my living the best way I know how. And eventually he ended up going to prison for a few years for that. And I can remember being a kid and him writing me letters and saying, hey, you know, when I get out, things are going to be different. I'm going to spend more time with you. I think it's important. And the thing was, he got out and nothing ever changed. He went back to what he knew, and he ended up being in the streets for a few more years, and he went to jail. My dad was like the real, you ever seen the movie Catch Me If You Can? He was like the real Catch Me If You Can. You understand what I'm saying? When it came to doing checks and stuff like that. And so I can remember having that example from a very young age and seeing all the cars and houses. And I was like, it just never appealed to me. My mother was fortunate enough, and I was fortunate enough. She got married when I was about 3 or 4 years old to a great man by the name of Lawrence Hunt. And he was my stepfather, and he did everything in his power to just raise me the right way. And I'm so appreciative for that influence. Even right now, as a 45-year-old man, I think about the lessons in which he taught me and just different things about manhood and responsibility and all those things. And so I think having a father made a drastic difference in my life. My mother was a pretty tough lady. She's about 6'2", 6'3", and she didn't play. And my stepfather was about 6'5", and he didn't play either. So I grew up in a home where my parents were really about education. I remember being a kid and saying, hey, you know, I want to be a professional athlete. I want to do this, I want to do that. And my parents were always like, look, that's a great goal, but let me give you an amazing dream. Whatever you can do with your mind instead of your body will facilitate you to have a very, very lengthy career. I can remember my father getting tickets to take me to go see the Chicago Bulls. And I was sitting there watching them playing, and Michael Jordan was lighting them up that night. The arena, everybody was yelling and screaming, and I'm eating my popcorn, and I'm looking, and I got a pretzel in one hand and popcorn on the floor, and drinking a drink, and I'm having my best time ever. And he taps me on the shoulders when the Bulls call a timeout. And he says, son, let me ask you something. I said, what? He says, who has the greatest job in this whole arena? And I kind of looked at him because I thought it was a crazy question. And I was like, Michael Jordan. And he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, you see that box up there with those guys walking around eating those hot dogs? And I said, yeah. He says, they have the best job in the building. They're the ones who pay Michael Jordan. And so even though people may not be screaming for him, they're the reason why all this is going on. So I want you to learn the big picture approach to life. And so that just really kind of got me thinking in life. They said, you know what? Mike's going to retire one day, but the Bulls are still going to be here. Mike's going to have an injury one day, but guess what? The Bulls are still going to be here. And he's like, that's what I'm getting. I want you to learn about life. Being the guy that's still there as transitions continue to happen through life. And that lesson really, really stayed with me all through life. My father, I'm going to tell you something. It wasn't a good experience with him growing up, but those bad experiences with him made me, I think today, a much better father. So he would say, hey, I'm going to pick you up, you know, so get dressed. We're going to go. We're going to hang out for the day. And so my mother would say, hey, look, don't make this kid promises and you not show up. And I can remember one particular time getting dressed up. I mean, I had on my pants and my shirt and my tie. I paged him. He called me. I said, hey, I'm ready. He says, okay, I'll be there in a little while. And I can remember sitting in the window dressed up and waiting on my father to come. and waiting on him to come until the point that I fell asleep, and my stepfather picking me up and putting me to bed and taking my shoes off. And I kind of woke up as he was picking me up. I said, did he come? And he said, no, he didn't come. He says, but you know what? I'm here. And I always remember that memory, you know? And so for me, anything with my children, I don't care if it's a basketball game. I don't care if it's a football game. If I tell them I'm coming, I'm coming. And so through the years, I never hated my father because he was my father, but I didn't understand. And so with that, I was able to find out how he grew up, that, you know, his father one day said he was going out to the store to go get a pack of cigarettes. And he asked him and his brother, what did he want? And they said they wanted some candy. He said, okay, I'll be back. His father never came back. And he may have been like five or six. He never saw his father again. And so at that point, I kind of realized that my father didn't know how to be a father because he never had that example. So I grew up with those things. And I'll tell you something. Of course, they shape you, but I didn't let them break me. And I think some of these situations in our lives, they break us and they turn us into broken people. And so from that moment on in my life, as I went up, I had, like I said, I had a great stepfather. I was just very determined that I would never do that to my kids. And so no child of mine can say, hey, I sat there on the doorstep and waited for my dad to come and he didn't come. And that's important to me.
And you're listening to Ron Brown and his real dad, his biological dad. Well, he was a character right out of Catch Me If You Can, just a black version, passing checks, living a bad life, making bad choices. He grew up, though, in a home that was all about education, a stepdad that really loved him right. He said, those bad experiences with my biological father made me a better father. And I never hated my father. I didn't understand him until I learned about how he grew up. His father's father, when he was 5 or 6 years old, went to the corner store and never came back. When we come back, more of Ron Brown's story here on Our American Story. Folks, if you love the great American stories we tell and love America like we do, we're asking you to become a part of the Our American Stories family. If you agree that America is a good and great country, please make a donation. A monthly gift of $17.76 is fast becoming a favorite option for supporters. Go to OurAmericanStories.com now and go to the donate button and help us keep the great American stories coming. That's OurAmericanStories.com. And we're back with Our American Stories and Ron Brown's story. We left off with Ron describing his difficult relationship with his absent father and the lessons he learned from that. Back to Ron with the rest of this story.
The funny story about it is that he came to my high school graduation at Holy Trinity, and he made a big deal about it, and he told me he was so proud of me for graduating high school. And I think I saw him a little bit over that summer, and I never saw him again. I didn't see him again until 20 years later, which is really kind of crazy because he had a brother and his brother had died. And so I think I was living in Atlanta at the time and I got word that my father had died. And I thought he had actually died, but it was kind of some confusion. So for years, I thought he was dead. A few summers after that, my wife sent some information in for us to be on the Family Feud. And so we become contestants on the Family Feud with Steve Harvey. And they tape it up in Atlanta, and we go ahead and we have this show, and we lose by one question. And we were like, man, we came all the way up here, we had a good time, but it would have been nice if we would have won. And so this is what I think about how everything happens for a reason. Well, fast forward years later, because after you do a Family Feud episode, they keep playing the episode over and over and over and over and over again. And so it stays in rotation for years. And so I had just started law school, and I was making a trek from Atlanta to Birmingham 3 nights a week for school. And it was one particular night I was leaving criminal law class, and I get a phone call from a number I had never seen before. And I was like, who's this calling me this late? It's about, I don't know, 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. And I answered the phone, and it's just something about your parents' voice. You never forget it. And even though I hadn't heard my father's voice for 20 plus years, the phone rings and I answer it, and he says, hello, son. And at that moment, I just broke down and cried. I had to pull over to the side of the road of Highway 20. And I was like, Dad? And he was like, Son, I've been looking for you. And I was like, I've been looking for you. I was like, how did you get my number? And it was a ray of emotions. And I was crying and he was crying. And he said, you know, I went and did some time and, you know, I lost track of you when I got out and I didn't know where you were. He said, I always knew you. You always said you wanted to be in business. You wanted to be a businessman. And I looked and looked. And he says, I'm going to tell you something. I actually was sitting down with my girlfriend the other night. We were watching Family Feud. He says, I never watched Family Feud. It's her favorite show. And it came to you and you said your name. And he said, that's my son. And she said, that's not your, she's like, no, that's my son. That's who I've been looking for. That's my son. He's like, she didn't believe me. He says, well, what he did was he listened to my mother-in-law, Dawn White. When you do that, the Family Feud, they ask you, what do you do and where do you live and all that. And so at that moment in time, she was a senior VP for Coca-Cola. And she said that. And so his girlfriend and him called Coca-Cola. They got in contact with her and she did some vetting. I didn't even know this was going on, but she did some vetting and to make sure who he said he was. And then they called my wife and they went on a three-way. And my wife was like, we thought you were dead. And he's like, no, that's my brother. And they gave him my number. And we talked for about an hour. And I just told him, you know what? Despite everything in the world, I still love you and you're my father. You're the reason why I'm here. And that was very important to me because I lost my mother back when I was 27 years old. So him and I kind of reconnected when I was probably like around 38. And so that was a powerful moment for me because as a man, even though I had a wife and the children I had, you still feel a level of loneliness because my parents, you know, I felt that both my parents were gone and it just, I would always ask myself, well, who buries me? You know, if something happens to me, you know, I guess with him, but due to the fact that he was still alive, we went ahead and put our relationship back together that night. I actually ended up flying to go see him 2 days later and I spent my birthday with him. But I can give you an irony of that though. My wife had our second son, Jackson. And so she said, what do you want to name him? And we got some names. I said, we're going to name him Jackson. I said, but his middle name is going to be Owen. And so my wife was very surprised. She was like, why would you name him Owen? Your father and you guys didn't have the best relationship. Why would you name him Owen? I said, you know what? Despite us not having the greatest relationship, I still love my father. And I wanted him to be better. And at that time in his life, maybe he couldn't be. I said, but you know what? I forgive him for everything that's happened in my life. I just forgive him and I can't hold on to it. And I said, you know, Jackson Owen Brown, you know, he'll make that name good. This kid will never go to the penitentiary. This kid will do something great with his life and will have his grandfather's name. And so my wife thought that was very powerful. And she said, okay, his name will be Jackson Owen Brown. Well, the irony of that is that my son was born like about 2 weeks before my father came back in my life. So I don't know if people think about life and letting things go and getting right with God or getting right with who you are as an individual. But I actually believe in my heart that of me making that decision to forgive my father for everything that had happened in the past, every hurt, every hardship, every disappointment, and giving my youngest son his name, I think for some way that opened a door and that allowed us to find each other. And that's been 7 years ago. And so now we talk every other day. That's my guy. He came to my law school graduation and he was very proud. And he looked and said, you know what? To see how I did everything wrong in life and to see that you did so much right, I'm just so proud of you. So that's a big part of my journey. So even though he didn't start off being the most amazing dad in the world, years later, he's become a great, 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 a great dad and a great grandfather. You know, something my parents would always teach me, my mom always taught me, was the importance of forgiveness, that nobody's perfect. Everyone does something wrong. And she would always talk about, you know, when Jesus would say, who could throw the first stone? And no one can throw the first stone. And even though he didn't get it right, I was open to allowing him to get it right. I was open. I think you have to be open sometimes. And it's a big thing. You have to forgive because here you are carrying that around with you. I just really think that it just really, really erodes your spirit. It erodes everything in you because you're carrying around the baggage and the hurt of something that happened years and years and years ago. And when you can't get over it and you can't move past it, it keeps you locked in that place. One of my good friends, he's a mentor of mine. He always said that anger is a wasted emotion. Anger will cost you a lot in your life. There are a lot of people sitting in the penitentiary right now because they were angry in a second and they did something that if they could take back, they would. And so I just learned the importance of just, you can't hold on to it. Sometimes you got to move on and move past it, but you can't hold on to it because it keeps you stuck. So there's a line in the Bible where Jesus said, how many times should you forgive somebody? And it's an enormous number. It's like 60 times, 60 times. You know, it's really kind of crazy that that's what the Lord and Savior says, that, that you should. And I'll give you the greatest story of that is that Jesus knew that Judas was going to be a Judas. You know, Jesus knew that he was going to be betrayed by Judas, but Jesus still continued the journey with him. And so it was all the fact that he knew he was going to betray him, but he still loved him. And that's an important message right there. He still loved him. He knew he was going to do what he did, but he still loved him and he kept him around. If you read the Bible, you know, there was points where, you know, they kind of felt that he was stealing, but Jesus was so in love with the man and the relationship that that didn't even matter. And that's pretty tough in this day and age for someone to still love someone, even though that's the way it is. But you know what? I equate that to like a true father's love. You know, our kids don't always do what we want them to do. They don't always go the way we want them to go, but they're still our children and we still love them and we still desire relationships with them and we still wish them well. And I think that's how God looks at us on the throne, even though we get up in the morning and maybe we have great intentions and some people have bad intentions, but they go out here and they do things. But he's still in love with you. He's still in love with who you are. And the door is always open for you to come back. There's nothing you've done that's been too enormous that God can't forgive. And I think that's the most powerful thing about the Christian faith, is that the door is always open for you. And I'm nowhere near Jesus Christ. I'm nowhere near God, but I've learned the importance of keeping the door open because people can change. People can change.
What a message from Ron Brown. And when faith is a part of people's lives, we put it right out there. And his forgiveness, which came straight from his faith, well, it opened a door. And my goodness, what a door it opened. And my goodness, what he did with his wife just weeks before, wanting to name his son after the father that was never there with the middle name. And the wife saying, what gives? And him walking through that he'd forgiven his own dad and teaching his wife the power of forgiveness. And 2 weeks later, that call comes. I've been looking for you. Hello, son. And he said, I just cried. Some of us believe in coincidence. Some of us believe in fate and destiny. And some of us believe in God. And for believers, that's a God moment, a God wink if ever there is one. Ron Brown's story, and we'd love to hear yours. Send your stories to OurAmericanStories.com. That's OurAmericanStories.com. Ron Brown's story, a beauty, here on Our American Stories. This is Our American Stories, and we love bringing you stories about history and about sports. And today, we bring you a combination of the two. Here's Mike Gibbons, Director Emeritus and Historian at the Babe Ruth Birthplace and Museum, also located in Baltimore, to tell us more about the legendary Baltimore football team that helped the NFL become what it is today.
Today we're going to be talking about the Baltimore Colts, one of the NFL's storied franchises, a team that helped put the NFL on the map for a variety of reasons, but also helped to give Baltimore a new identity. During World War II, Baltimore was one of the industrial centers of the United States, producing ships and aircraft for the war effort. But at the conclusion of World War II in 1945, the industries really lost their market. They didn't have to produce ships and aircraft in the numbers that they did during World War II. And so many of the plants in and around this area closed down, and Baltimore lost its manufacturing capability. The town gradually slipped and declined and became known really as nothing more than a pit stop between Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. The Baltimore Colts arrived on the scene in 1953, and though in the beginning they were not very good at all, it gave Baltimoreans and Marylanders something to look forward to on Sunday afternoons in the fall. The team in 1956 had started to get a little bit better under head coach Weeb Ewbank, and he started a quarterback by the name of George Shaw. In the fourth game of 1956, Shaw was injured. In to replace him came a rookie quarterback by the name of Johnny Unitas. Johnny went to the University of Louisville, where he was a star quarterback, and he was drafted in 1955 by the Pittsburgh Steelers. But he lost out in the competition for quarterback to a fellow who would later show up on the Baltimore landscape, a guy by the name of Ted Marchibroda. So Unitas played semi-pro ball in his hometown of Pittsburgh and waited for a phone call that ultimately came before the start of training camp in 1956. And that call came from Colts general manager Don Kellett. For the price of a 90-cent long-distance phone call, Kellett was able to secure Unitas and bring him to Baltimore. He played well enough in training camp and in exhibition games to make the roster and was George Shaw's backup. So now we go forward to game four. The Colts did not play well under their rookie quarterback, who threw an interception for a touchdown return, and the Colts fumbled four times, losing badly to the Chicago Bears that day. But over the last eight games in 1956, with Unitas at the helm, the team went 4-4, and there was hope for a brighter future. I went to my first game in 1957, the home opener against the Detroit Lions. I was, 10 years old at the time, and what a spectacle it was to go out there on a Sunday afternoon, beautiful day, and I remember squinting my eyes because the Colts wore white helmets and you could see the sun glitter off of those helmets. The team the Colts faced in that home opener, Unitas' first home opener, by the way, as a starter, were the world champion Detroit Lions. Well, the Colts, under Unitas' leadership and strong arm, put a licking on Detroit that day, winning the game and propelling to a pretty good season for the Colts. They finished with a record of 7-5 with a lot of burgeoning stars, guys like Gino Marchetti, Lenny Moore, Raymond Berry, Unitas, Artie Donovan, all future Hall of Famers. There they were in Baltimore, and we knew that we had something special. In 1958, the Colts went 9-3 and captured the Western Conference crown. That took them to the championship game at Yankee Stadium in New York, where the Colts would face the Giants. Weeb Eubank, in the visitors' locker room at Yankee Stadium that day, gave a pregame speech to his team, referencing every one of them, walking around to all 33 players, addressing them, and saying, "You wouldn't be in the NFL if it wasn't for your Baltimore Colts. You really never had it together until you got here. So go out there, play your best, and give it all you've got." The 1958 game is often referred to as the greatest game ever played. And the reason is Johnny Unitas and what he was able to do to pull out the game in what turned out to be the NFL's first sudden death overtime. Late in the fourth quarter, with the Colts trailing by 3 points, Unitas gets the ball back on his own 14-yard line, 86 yards from the Giants' goal line. And Johnny, at that moment, invented the two-minute drill. He took his team down to the 13-yard line with about 10 seconds left on the clock. Steve Meyer, the place kicker, came in, kicked a 19-yard field goal to tie the game and send the game into overtime. In overtime, the Colts stopped the Giants on a contested, controversial placement of the ball. The Giants swear that they got a first down on Frank Gifford's third down run, but the referees said, "Nope, you didn't make it," and they punted to the Colts. And the Colts, under Johnny Unitas, took the team down the field and into the end zone, Alan Ameche scoring the game-winning TD for a 23-17 victory. So that was that game was witnessed by the largest audience ever to see an NFL game on television. TV was still pretty new at that time. And the high drama that played out that afternoon was never forgotten by the fans who watched it. The game is often said to be responsible for putting the NFL on the map. It certainly put Johnny Unitas and his Baltimore Colts on the map. They went on to become one of the premier franchises in the history of the league. In Unitas' 16 seasons as a starting quarterback from 1957 through 1972, they suffered only one losing season, and that was their last season, 1972, John's last season in Baltimore. But up to them, they had the best record in the NFL for 15 years under Unitas, and they were tied with the Cleveland Browns for most wins over that period in the NFL. So a pretty successful team. Now, other things to think about when we're talking Baltimore Colts football is a series of firsts that took place at Baltimore's Memorial Stadium, better known as the largest outdoor insane asylum. I remember going to my third game in 1960. My father and I got season tickets, and we sat in the end zone where the Colts came out for pregame introductions. And I'll tell you, when Unitas took the field and was introduced to the crowd in the closed end of this horseshoe-shaped stadium, it was the loudest sound I've ever heard to this day, the biggest noise I've ever heard. That stadium, just by its architecture and by the enthusiasm of the fans, 60,238 every weekend that they played, just was almost unimaginable to comprehend.
And we've been listening to Mike Gibbons tell the story, not just of the Baltimore Colts, but in the end, a story of Baltimore itself, especially post-World War II. And by the way, Mike Gibbons is the director emeritus and historian at the Babe Ruth Birthplace and Museum, which is in Baltimore. And by the way, if you're ever there, go. When we come back, more of the story of the Baltimore Colts, of Johnny Unitas, and more with the sports historian of the city of Baltimore here on Our American Story. And we're back with Our American Stories and the story of the Baltimore Colts, the football team that helped put Baltimore and the NFL in the spotlight. Here's Mike Gibbons again to tell us about this historic team and the presence that they had in the world of professional football.
Vince Lombardi from the Green Bay Packers, the legendary Hall of Fame coach, said that he hated coming to Memorial Stadium, the worst place on the road for his team to visit. And it wasn't just the sound. The Colts had cheerleaders. They were the first team in the NFL to have cheerleaders. They were the second to have a marching band. And they had a great fight song, and which the town just loved. And every time the band played it, we all stood as though it was our national anthem. The Colts had a mascot, a live horse, Dixie, who with Dixie's rider would go around the outside of the playing field every time the team scored. And this really pretty much unnerved the opposing teams as they came to Baltimore and contested the Colts. And that's one of the reasons we think that the Colts had such a great record over all the years. Another profound memory for me was 1959. So the year after the Colts had beaten the Giants in the greatest game ever played in New York, the Colts and the Giants repeated the exercise by playing the NFL championship game in Baltimore, and I was there with my dad. The Colts win the game, and fans ran onto the field. Everybody was so excited, they didn't know what to do, and I kept saying to my dad, let me go down there. And he was like, no, you're not going down there. You might get hurt. What they were trying to do was to dissemble the goalpost down in the closed end of the playing field, not really understanding that the NFL had changed from a wooden goalpost the year before to an all-metal goalpost in 1959. So they were able to knock the goalpost down, but not much more than that. Let me take you up to 1965. The Colts and the Packers were vying for the league championship. The Colts had won it the year before, 1964, And now they're vying with Green Bay for the conference title in 1965. The teams finished the regular season with identical 10-3-1 marks, and that forced a playoff game in Green Bay. And the Colts headed out there at a severe disadvantage. The Colts' number one quarterback, Johnny Unitas, had been injured earlier in the year. His replacement, Gary Quazo, was injured in the second-to-last game of the year, and that forced running back Tom Matte to come in and play quarterback. Tom had played quarterback at Ohio State, but it was a running offense, and so they didn't throw the ball a lot, and Tom was not an elite passer by any means. But Tommy came in, and the Colts took a lead of 7-0 early on in the game. And as the game came to a conclusion, the fourth quarter winding down, the Colts were clinging to a 10-7 lead over the Green Bay Packers. And at that point, Packer kicker Don Chandler came in. He booted a field goal that was ruled good by the referees, even though it appeared to sail wide. It was a high kick, went way up over the goalpost, and seemed to veer to the left. But the referees allowed the points, thereby tying the game, and the Packers went on to win in the second overtime game ever played. The first, of course, the Colts participated in as well in 1958 in New York. Now we move up to 1971. The Colts, under Unitas, make another postseason appearance, losing to the Miami Dolphins, but nevertheless they made it as they headed into the 1972 season. Problem with this team at that point was that they were getting old. A lot of the veteran players were just kind of running out of gas, so it was up to Unitas to try and carry them forward one more time, but he couldn't do it. He was replaced about midway through the season by Marty Domrays. Domrays guided the Colts to a 5-9 record that year. In the last home game, something profound happened, and Baltimoreans will never forget it. The last home game, the Colts were hosting the Buffalo Bills, not a very good team either. Midway through the fourth quarter, Domrays had taken his squad to a 28-7 lead over the Bills. At that point, he was on the field, and he feigned an injury and hopped off the field. And, you know, the head coach said to Unitas, get in there. So Johnny went in, and as that was happening, a small biplane flew over Memorial Stadium carrying a banner that said, Unitas, we stand. And the sellout crowd stood as one and started cheering as the fabled legendary Unitas made what many knew would be his last appearance on Memorial Stadium turf. Unitas went out, took a snap from center, dropped back, and threw a 67-yard touchdown pass to Eddie Hinton. And then he ran off the field for the last time. The crowd sobbing, cheering, just going out of their minds, having witnessed one of the great moments in Colts and maybe in NFL history. Storybook stuff you just can't make up. Unitas and many of the veterans were let go or traded after the 72 season, and something had happened after 71 that was not a good thing for our Colts. Colts owner Carol Rosenblum, one of the greatest in NFL history, sold his team to Bob Irsay, and Irsay was not a good owner, and he brought in a general manager by the name of Joe Thomas, who wanted to run things his way, and Joe was responsible after 72 for cleaning house, getting rid of the players. So the next couple of years, 73 and 74, under Joe Thomas and a variety of head coaches, the Colts were terrible. But in 75, they brought in a guy who Unitas had dealt with before back in Pittsburgh when he lost the quarterback job to who would become the Colts' new head coach, Ted Marchibroda. So Marchibroda comes to town. He takes second-year quarterback Burt Jones and says, Burt, let's make this thing go. Jones had a lot of great players with him, and they returned the Colts to the path of glory as the team captured Eastern Conference championships in 75, 76, and 77. Unfortunately, they had three postseason berths and lost them all, first two to Pittsburgh in the final one, and historic game at Memorial Stadium to the Oakland Raiders, which the Colts lost to in double overtime, 37-31, I believe. That game, played on Christmas Eve that year, turned out to be the last playoff game that Baltimore fans would ever see their Colts participate in. In the summer of 1978, Burt Jones was hurt in an exhibition game, hurt his shoulder, and was out for a while, tried to make a comeback, and it just wasn't the same, and the team floundered without Burt's generalship out there and had a losing season. The Colts would never have a winning season again, as they lost 6 years in a row. The final 6 years in Baltimore, they were losers. And that, coupled with Irsay's unpredictable behavior as an owner, and Joe Thomas as the GM just tearing that squad apart, led to a real drop in attendance. I think the last game they played in 1983, they drew 32,000 people. They remember that they had been drawing 60,000 sellouts every game for years, and now they were doing barely half of that. That led to Irsay shopping around the team and ultimately moving them out of town to Indianapolis on a dark night in late March 1984. Word got out, people saw that the Colts had moving vans backed up to their training facility, and Bobby Irsay, under the cover of darkness, snuck them out of town as they headed to Indy. Now, something profound and good happened to the city regarding its Baltimore Colts. Shortly after that, Baltimore Mayor William Donald Schaefer instructed Tom Matte to go to Indianapolis and negotiate with Irsay to try and get the Baltimore Colts archives to come back to Baltimore. He was successful. So Schaefer got a moving van of the Baltimore Colts archives delivered, and that day we became the Baltimore Colts official archives and museum. In 2005, our museum opened another museum called Sports Legends Museum at Camden Yards, and it featured, among other things, a major display on the history of the Baltimore Colts. It turned out to be one of the most popular exhibits in that museum. People would go in there and get tears in their eyes just thinking about their great Baltimore Colts teams. They really, as I said before, were more than just an NFL franchise. They were part of the fabric of this community and part of what made the NFL what it has become today. We called that exhibit Almost Religion because, in fact, that's what the Baltimore Colts were to the city of Baltimore.
An excellent job, as always, to Robbie, and a special thanks to Mike Gibbons, Director Emeritus and Historian at the Babe Ruth Birthplace and Museum. The story of the Baltimore Colts here on Our American Stories.